I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, and welcome to The Legacy Tapes, a series of podcasts that explore how you can leave something lasting in the ephemeral medium of theatre. I'm Rebecca Atkinson-Lord, and I'm here with David Eldridge. David Eldridge is one of our nation's great playwrights. His work's been on at the Royal Court, the Almeida, the National Theatre, and the Bush and the Finborough before that. You might have heard of his work, Feston, Under the Blue Sky, Beginning, Market Boy, in Basildon. His work has sort of tracked the last two decades, I reckon. Hi, David.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm all right. Yeah, good.
Really good. People always are really awkward when I do the introduction because that's like, they're like, what is it you're going to choose is interesting about me?
Well, I always, it's not so much that, it always sort of makes me want to laugh a bit, just because you sort of think, it's a bit pinch yourself, I think.
Yeah.
You suddenly find yourself in these situations, that's all really, but it was very nice, thank you.
Oh, good, didn't worry. So the pinch yourself thing, is that because you didn't expect, is that because you sound more successful than you feel you are? Or is that because you didn't expect to be this cool and eminent playwright? Or what is the pinch yourself stuff about?
God, well, I mean, I don't know, cool.
Now middle-aged, but what maybe one's cool.
I think it's just that I'm really pleased about the work that I've done over the years and the work that I continue to do. But equally, there are things that I sort of hoped might happen, but never ever expected might happen. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so, therefore, when some of these things have happened, they are sort of sources of delight. And then when sort of people recapitulate them, then they seem quite funny. Yeah. That's all, And that's not that I'm not serious about what I do. It's just that I think that's what it is. There's kind of somewhere within it a source of delight that this thing that never seemed likely to happen has in fact happened a bit.
Yeah, bloody hell, that happened.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. Okay. I'm talking because you listened to the Rupert Gould episode and liked it. And I was like, cheekily, will you be my guest? Because you're the first playwright guest. Which is an interesting thing.
That's an honour, thank you.
I mean, you can take it as an honour, but I think it's just ill thought out on my part, really.
That's all right. A happy accident.
Yeah. I'm really kind of curious because when you're a writer, you leave something lasting, right? Like, you've got books and shit.
Yes.
Are you aware of your publications as this thing you will leave behind for your kids, or do you think of what you do more as in the kind of the ephemeral theatre stage way?
Well, I think of what I do is in the theatre, of course. Mm. And you're quite right to sort of talk about its ephemerality and stuff. And I've always liked a phrase that David Hare coined, the play is in the air, mm-hmm. which feels true to me. It's something I recognise as true, as something that's happening between an audience and a live performance. However, as you say, certainly within our current culture, the plays are published, copies are lodged at the British Library.
Yeah.
I remember the
first time I did that. I was like, oh my God, it's like, it's meaningful. Yeah, suddenly. Yeah. This piece of nonsense is meaningful.
Yeah, and of course, you're quite right in a way as well to mention children, because I've got two sons, and, as someone who's sort of about to sort of hit 46 in a couple of weeks, you do start to sort of very gradually sort of think about things in a slightly different way, I think. Mm. In terms of life. And so, it's become part of a mental checklist that I've sort of got that will obviously never happen if I get hit by a bus tomorrow, but like if must at some point have some copies of plays and odd reviews and put them in a box for the boys in case anything happens to me. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, so, totally. So they know what you achieved.
Yeah. So, but of course, in terms of the writing of the plays, I'm thinking about the play being on. Mm. And sometimes I imagine the theatre that I want the play to be on in, or that have commissioned the play as I write it. And sometimes I just imagine the location of the scene.
Mm-hmm.
But absolutely what I'm not thinking about is the very nice Methuen publication of the play, you know, once it's all sort of happening, you know.
Yeah. It exists in people's mouths, not on the paper when you're first writing it.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the thing that I sort of talk about often, because it means so much to me, is that it's about sort of, kind of 10 years or so ago now, it was kind of all around the same time, I was working on a version of John Gabriel Balkman for the Donmar Warehouse that was done specifically. I knew that kind of Ian McDermott and Penelope Wilton were going to be in it, so I sort of slightly, when I wrote the version, was sort of listening to their voices all the time, so some of, you know, some of them somehow was in it. But I remember sort of Ian at the time talking about being happy with my draft because it went at the speed of his thought. And that was something that, yeah, I've really carried with me since then, that, you know, writing at the speed of an actor's thought.
Mm.
And then around the same time, there was one Sunday where me and my ex-wife were just watching a bit of Sunday afternoon telly, and there was this documentary about the fashion designer, now since disgraced, John Galliano.
Mm-hmm.
And a woman that worked with him in his fashion house was saying that one of the reasons she thought he was such a great designer was because he designed for a body in motion, not a tailor's dummy.
Yeah.
And that kind of went kaplunk. And I actually sort of turned to sort of my ex-wife in a very un-Gogglebox-like way and said, oh, well, I think that's what playwrights do.
Yeah.
You know, and they're both of those things of, you know, they were articulations of things that I suppose I felt I was doing all along. It's just great when someone says something that distills something in such a clear way for you, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense. Yes. Now I understand.
Yeah.
And totally, I really like that thing about writing at the speed of the actor's thought, because I think as a director, one of the things that I spend so much time saying is, let me see you have the fucking thought before you open your mouth.
Yeah.
You know, let me, you know, let me see that thing land in you and have an impulse. So it's super, thanks, that's useful for my job.
Well, also as well, it's also, you know, the kind of writing that's kind of on the lot, you know, where kind of the thought is on the line, you know, like where it's really kind of moment by moment, you know. And I think genuinely it's something, the more that you have to really kind of write for the present tense of the actor and the audience, really, so that they can exist beautifully together in the present tense, you know. And I think that, you know, that I think it's one of the reasons often why actors make really good writers, actually, you know, because it's something that's really in their bones. And often, you know, I mean, I was just talking about this last night to my partner about an actor that I knew, and was talking about how erudite actors are and how learned they are.
Yeah.
Because they go off and do all these different jobs and learn about all these things, you know. And actors, I think, are often the most educated and erudite and literary people, but they don't necessarily come from kind of literary culture, you know, which often I think, you know, really makes them really great playwrights often. And I think those of us that maybe don't start out as actors or performers in that sense, there's often a bit of a shaking off of that kind of English lit culture a bit somehow, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and learning to not follow the rules or disregard the weight of the canon almost when you need to, I think. You
know,
argue with me.
Yeah. No. Well, I agree with that. I mean, I think that I've been a writer that's always kind of been interested in kind of in both the kind of line that I stand in, but also kind of the form in terms of playwriting, in terms of models for the form. So just to put some kind of flesh on that thought, so with a play like In Basildon, I really looked seriously at the four major Chekhov plays, not so much because I wanted to somehow imitate a Chekhovian gesture or tone, but I was kind of more interested in seeing how he told a story in four acts and what that did and what were the pros and cons of that. But of course, then when you do that, there's that, and then there's the reality of what the characters are like when you bring them to life, yeah. You know. And I sort of think that I always have to kind of, going back to that first thought of trying to create something that can be alive on the moment, go back to kind of what feels right and exciting moment by moment. So, yeah, you might have spent all these weeks looking at these four-act structures, but actually Ken wants to say this to Barry. And so yeah. Therefore that's what
so
you
Ken's
write.
Gonna say it to Barry. Yeah,
of course. Yeah. It's interesting in that as well. And I had discovered a really good thing actually when I wrote the play Under the Blue Sky and this line, which was that I wrote the first act in a very structured way. I kind of had this idea that modern audiences' kind of attention spans are kind of as long as an ad break or a pop song, probably.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's ridiculous, really, but yeah. Just sort of something that kind of obsessed me a bit in my mid and late
20s. Yeah.
And I sort
Although
of thought...
now, like, ooh, 3 minutes for a pop song, that's a long
that's
time.
That's a lot,
sure
very long
now.
Time. Yeah. In a world of 140 characters, no way, it's an ice age that now. But anyway, at the time... I sort of thought this, and I thought, well, I had an idea of the shape, and I thought, well, if these acts are roughly half an hour each, in this first act, at least 10, there's got to be at least 10 key bits of story.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of worked it out in quite a rigorous way, and then wrote it, and then, of course, there was discovery and deviation from that plan as I brought the characters to life. But kind of, you know, it kind of, like, I felt as well that I kind of each hit each kind of note and that, you know, as I kind of hoped I might. Now, you get to act two, and I thought, well, this worked out great, and this is what I think the story is, and I'm going to try and do the same for act two. But basically, it was a complete failure because the characters were drunk. You know, the characters are drunk and trying to have sex with each other at 1 a.m. And the characters just would not... That kind of disciplined writing, which worked really well for two characters who were very tense and uptight and having the first drink of the evening, did not work at all for these two people that were pissed out of their minds, you know.
Yeah.
So I kind of had to abandon that, really, and kind of find a different way of shaping that part of the play, you know?
Yeah, because they just wouldn't do what they were told.
Yeah,
like,
of course.
They didn't fit, yeah.
Yeah, of course, you know.
Yeah, nice. I'm just because we were right at the start, I'm going to try and wrestle it back to the topic, which I'm shit at always.
No.
But, you know, let's do it now and then we can deviate. Tell me how you... Like, tell me how you got here, basically. How did you, like, here in this office at Birkbeck, where you are, where you teach writing, how did you get from your first day at primary school or whatever to here? Why the hell and how?
Well, I think, you know, without taking 15 hours or anything, right? I was a bright kid and I definitely was interested in... I had a kind of vibrant imagination and I enjoyed doing bits of creative writing. And I went through my school career like that, do you know what I mean, at junior school. When I was coming up to going to senior school, I had parents who were from a very sort of working class, blue collar type background. EastEnders had moved out in the 1970s to Essex. And I had an uncle who'd done all right for himself who suggested that, you know, that because the schools weren't very good in Romford at that time, particularly the secondary schools, that I should be put forward for sort of grammar schools and private schools. And so my kind of parents sort of, in a slightly sort of befuddled way, I think, really, just sort of thought, why not? With the encouragement of a teacher as well at my junior school. And I think much to everyone's amazement and delight, I got in all of them. And all of these places offered, you know, part scholarships. I don't think I was actually offered a full scholarship for anywhere, actually, but it was irrelevant because I was offered a part scholarship, and the other 50% would be made up by the local education authority assisted places scheme, which existed then.
Yeah.
Actually, I think something that's morally wrong, and I'm quite glad that the Labour government abolished it when they came in the 90s, but it's just true that I did benefit from it, you know. So I guess I benefited then from the age of sort of 11, 12 with this kind of public school education. But still nothing to do with writing or drama. I was more interested in getting through. I didn't feel like I belonged at school. I didn't enjoy it very much. I kept my head down, played a bit for the school football team. I think I was really focused on being Mr. Average and Mr. Get Through It Without Being Noticed.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah. And it was basically when I was a sixth former, went into sixth form to do A-levels, there was kind of a trinity of things that came together, really, which was that I'd started to really enjoy school because I was concentrating on three A-levels that I wanted to
get. Yeah, you actually gave a shit about.
Yeah, which was English history and politics, and they're still my great loves in a way.
Yeah.
It's the first thing. Second thing, like through my teenage years, it was just horrifying, kind of having a home life where we had no money. And the house looked terrible. I never had any friends from school home because I was too embarrassed. Had a complete divide in my life between home life, having a job in Romford Market as a teenager, and then putting on a horrible grey tweed school uniform and going to school and being a public school boy. I'm kind of, as a kind of 17-year-old going into sixth form, I sort of, like some strange kind of penny started to drop. As girls appeared in sixth form, it was an all boys school until that point. And, you know, guys at school, you know, like started to get into kind of the Stone Roses and the Happy Mondays and go to, like, there's, you know, that kind of, probably because of the kind of school that I was at, people really conformed right through adolescence, really, right up until sixth form. And it was almost like people started to break out in sixth form and suddenly find different kind of countercultural sort of, you know, expressions of themselves.
Yeah.
So all of this kind of happened sort of together. I realised actually that kind of, you know, I was probably a bit more interesting to the girls on the basis of having a bit of edginess. So actually it wasn't necessarily something to conceal.
Yeah.
You know, I had kind of, I sort of found mates at school that were interested in similar things to me in a way that I didn't. And there was a new drama teacher at school. And I took the very ignoble decision to do a GCSE in drama alongside my A-levels because I thought it would be a bit of a doss.
Yeah.
Little did I know that within a few weeks it would literally transform my life, you know. Yeah. And that is how I got here, you know. I mean, you know, I could spend another 15 hours talking about every nook and cranny of the but essentially that's kind of got me onto kind of being directed into this kind of world and then kind of running into this world, really, you know, because when I kind of thought this is what I want to do, I want to be a part of this, I did everything that I could to work hard towards that, you know. So yeah, that's kind of how it happened, really, I think.
Because I think, I mean, it's super interesting hearing you talk about that, because I think, because I'm from not such a different background, and I was a scholarship kid at an independent school as well, and I think definitely, I mean, my parents would quite on the whole, quite culturally engaged because my dad's a potter.
Yeah.
So, but he'd been a craft potter in the 60s and 70s, so it was like a trade almost, yeah, rather than this high art. So if I ever call him an artist, he sort of swears at me because he's not. It sounds a bit wanky, you know. And so, yeah, I think my school drama teacher was the first, was the reason that I do this now.
Yeah.
Just because I can't quite place why I found it transformative, why it was so compelling, other than just this place to imagine and be other. I think there's something in me about being greedy for more life. Like, I know I'm going to die, so let's see if we can get 80 other lives
that
in here.
Good, yeah.
That's what I'm doing. So it's just sort of interesting hearing you talk about that, because I remember like reading your blog. Yeah. Is Rascal still
alive? He died last year, actually. Yeah.
Oh, man, I'm so sorry.
That's all right. Horrible. Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I remember reading your blog, and I remember, you know, I remember Market Boy and like just your work kind of hitting the culture as I was sort of becoming a professional theatre maker.
Sure.
And sort of being really sort of aware of you as this icon of working class lad done good, right? If you'll forgive me.
And it's sort of
really interesting for me now to meet you, and I'd never twigged that you'd gone to independent school and you'd had that similar journey to me until literally researching for this podcast. So it's super, super interesting to come across that. And
well, people ignore it. This is the thing. I mean, maybe I'm, you know, like amongst all the different things maybe that happen as you get into sort of what we call middle age and think about, maybe I'm becoming slightly more cynical maybe now than I was 10 years ago. But you realise that people tell the story that they want to tell. And I think that quite often the story that people wanted to tell about me wasn't one that involved the public school bit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Because that's just a bit complicated, a bit complex.
Yeah, and I think, and I think that's not just journalists. I think, you know, I should have kind of twigged onto this at my very first experience of being in the theatre, which is that on my very first press night in the professional theatre, Bush Theatre, February 1996, serving it up, as me, kind of 22, shitting myself. That's, I need a drink.
Classic Mike Bartlett era, right?
Oh, no, I'm before Mike Bartlett.
Fuck, okay.
Yeah, no. Okay. I'm before Bartlett. But basically, and so there I am, crapping my pants. And I'd gone to the Bush Bar and ordered myself a gin and tonic. Because I obviously worried about needing a wee, you know, and all that, and the old Bush.
Oh, yes,
like,
and not a pint.
Sensible,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Not a pint.
You don't want to pee, yeah.
And Deborah Eden, who was the general manager at the Bush, literally snatched it out of my hand and said to me, "We don't want Michael Billington seeing you drinking a gin and tonic." And she took my gin and tonic and she bought me a pint of lager. And then I remember really laughing and thinking it was funny. And I still think it's funny, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's you know, I think that we in the theatre are also complicit a bit sometimes in the stories we want to tell about, you know, like...
identity. Yeah.
Yeah, of course. And I mean, you know, like Simon Stevens is an old mate, you know. And if you talk to Simon, there's a lot of complexity to Simon. But probably insofar as theatre is concerned, and then often insofar as the media is concerned, he's a rock and roll playwright, isn't he? Do you know what I mean? The boy that should really be fronting a rock band, but he's a playwright, you know? And I'm sure he won't mind me saying that, you know? That's something that he laughs about himself. But you know, so with regards to me, you know, the kind of independent school stuff often...
Yeah, it just slips away.
It can slip away, but it's something I've never denied, and I'm always quite happy to talk about, because to me, it partly, you know, the duality of it, I think most writers are outsiders in some way, you know, and I think actually looking back, probably the duality of it and not feeling, from the age of 12, sort of not feeling, you know...
Like one of them.
One of them, but also increasingly...
Not one of the other ones either.
Not from home, you know, like shades of kind of David Story. I mean, this is what Story wrote again and again and again, wasn't it? Yeah. You know, I mean, it's sort of apogee in a way is in The March on Russia, you know, where that's David Story type writer comes home for the family celebration around the parents' anniversary, you know. And, you know... But you know, that gives you a perspective, you know, I think, you know, on... It gives you a different perspective on the kind of... on the tribe, you know, because it means, I think, that you can kind of both be within it and without it, which is great as a writer. Remember Peter Gill talking to me about the royal family. Peter Gill absolutely loved, and I assume still loves, the royal family, and he used to watch it. And then and I remember having tea with him one afternoon and saying, talking about the royal family and how brilliant it was and all the rest of it. And he said, well, darling, you know, to observe and inhabit at the same time, you have to be cutting with diamond. And she's cutting with diamond. So, you know, like, and I think, and that's why I think sometimes being an outsider in a way within a world.
Yeah.
Both within and without a world, is sort of actually sort of it's useful as a writer, actually, I think.
Yeah. It's definitely because I made a show a couple of years ago called The Class Project, because of this exact thing, this sense of, like, I used to run a theatre, Oval House in South London.
Yes, I know, yes.
And a big part of the agenda there is about giving access to the mainstream narrative to folk that probably don't get it all the time. And I spent so much fucking time being shushed because I was too posh to talk about something. And I was like, I'm literally the only person in this room that didn't go to fucking Cambridge. Can you all fuck off? And it used to frustrate me so much because I'd done this, because, you know, I'm a Thatcher's child, and I'd done this thing of, like, social mobility, and I've, you know, I've always done everything I was ever supposed to fucking do, and I can pass with the best of them, but I'm still from there. And just the tension of that and being and feeling like, to be in the room, I had to own a certain identity, but by owning that and being in the room, that ruled me out from having a point of authority on anything that wasn't to do with posh middle class Waitrose shopping, I'm super aware of that kind of outsiderness. On all, you know, I can't go home. I'm totally like the posh arty one. Even though my parents are technically artists.
Yeah.
But I do things like, go, well, have you read? And they're like, no, obviously not. Yeah. We haven't done that.
Yeah.
But also I sort of swim through the theatre ecology and there are all of these tiny reminders, you know, there are all of the friends who are at my level who are really struggling to get along.
Yeah.
But they're struggling to get along in a rent-free house that was their parents' house in London, and I'm struggling to get along fucking paying ridiculous amounts of rent, you know. And just all of a sudden there are these little differences that cast me as an outsider, and I'm sort of really curious about this is not my podcast, I should shut up. Curious about, like, that what that interstitial liminal space is that is none of the things that people want to put you in. And, like, what it is to swim in that. I haven't got a question. I'm just talking about it.
Well, I think as a writer, I think that you can try and make work that explores that that space that you've described, that complicated area. And equally not feel that it's your responsibility to do that either. I mean, I think from a personal point of view, I think sometimes I write in a way that really does occupy that space. So I think Beginning is probably quite a good example of that. It's maybe the best example where they're kind of both oddly classless in a way. Do you know what I mean? Or they've been removed from their original classes somehow because of what they've lived through, you know, to get to this point. Both of them knocking 40. And I think then there are other things that I do that kind of go to either kind of either pole of my kind of experience, if you like. So, you know, kind of in Basildon is really getting quite rootsy, although there's this kind of middle class playwright in it, is really quite getting rootsy. In a play like The Knot of the Heart is really about, is writing in a world that I find myself in rather than one I kind of come out of. So I suppose in a way, as a writer, this is something I don't particularly agonise over. I just sort of think, I kind of want, I'm going to get in there somehow. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Try and find a way of getting in there and having a kind of a rummage around. I mean, I would say, Rebecca, though, that I think that, well, I've always had a keen sense over the years of things that I don't want to write or that would feel strange for me to write. Yeah. I do think actually that there is some kind of responsibility somehow as well for me to think about the time and energy that I've got and what I suppose I can bring to the table as a writer and an artist, and whether I really ought to be doing that when someone else can. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Is I think a really...
Yeah, yeah.
And that's not something that I has affected me particularly in the theatre, but like, for example, there was a TV thing I'm working on at the moment. It's a book that I read year before last, a novel, and I thought it was fantastic. It was a no-brainer for telly.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of had lunch with this TV producer. Like, it was ridiculous after beginning opened at the National. Like, you know, all these ridiculous people are ringing you up going, can we have lunch?
We've remembered you.
Yeah, we've forgotten about you. That's right. Yeah. Do you remember me? We did meet 3 years ago. And they're saying that suddenly. But on this lunch, and I sort of was a bit too busy to take anything new on. And I'd said that. I said it'd be good to make a relationship. So we're sort of having our lunch in Clerkenwell, and I started to talk about this book I'd read. And then this producer who I'm now working with thought I was pitching her. And I said, no, I'm too busy. But in any case, you know, this book is about this woman who's hitting 30, who is deciding to give up drink because she feels like she's destroying her life. And... I don't think this should be written by me. I think there's a practical issue that's to do with, you know, the fact that this character's a millennial. Then I'm, you know, I'm a Gen Xer. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I'm a different generation now. There must be someone better than me to write this book, write a version of this book. But also, like, you know, if there are all these different possibilities, which I think there are for any writer, whether you're being commissioned or not, you have choices about what you put your energy and your thought and your creativity into. Should I really be doing that? Shouldn't actually this be someone else do it? Shouldn't actually, there are all sorts of brilliant women who are in their early 30s. You know, I can mention half a dozen now. Shouldn't one of them be doing this? And, you know, what was great, actually, was that a couple of weeks later, they rang me up and said, we've read the book, we think you're right, it's a no-brainer for telly. We know you don't want to do it, and we think you're right, it should be, but do you want to be an exec producer on it? So it's been really fun. I've been exec producer on this project, and Millie Thomas is doing it.
Yeah.
You know, and she's done a fantastic job for us. She's written a fantastic script.
Can you tell us what it's called?
Yeah, it's called So Happy It Hurts.
Right.
It's a lovely book, and... you know, and she's perfect, and that feels to me entirely right. All of that feels entirely right. So, you know, it's, I suppose I'm kind of, on the one hand, joining you in resisting being put in my box.
Yeah.
While at the same time going, you know, when I'm reaching for something, or something seems like a good idea, there's also a separate conversation really about, you know, is this kind of really what I want to do, you know? And allied to that are all sorts of questions, other questions, actually, you know, because I think that, I think sometimes, you know, I don't know about other writers, sometimes there's an incredibly romantic thing about an idea. But other times it's actually a kind of, with me, I think it's more of a keen sense of something nagging away at me that won't go away. Mm-hmm. And actually I fall more in love with it when I've really got into it.
Yeah.
So for me, it would be wholly false to sort of say that there's this kind of, there's always this burning thing to do this. It's much more about a discovery of something as I do it. And then suddenly, you know, when you're into it, you sort of suddenly realise how much you love this and how it's a finding of it. And actually the things that aren't like that are the plays or screenplays that you get 15 pages in and there's nothing in this, you know?
Yeah.
It was a bit of a rambly kind of bit, but...
No, I think there's a lot in it. Like, I'm curious, because you said a thing about, is this the thing that I want to do? And sort of handing it over to a younger woman, and great, please, to everyone that's listening, please give more jobs to women, thanks.
Yeah, of course.
Because there's also something about, I was really interested in the way you came at it, which is this the thing that I want to do? And what I hear more of in the culture right now is, am I allowed to do this?
Yeah.
And so I was just super interested in your framing of that. That was interesting. That's the end of the question, really. Like, is that, like, are you conscious of, like, in that decision, were you conscious of a cultural shift that pushes you toward choosing that you didn't want to do it, or was it just about this is going to be fucker to write because I'm not in that voice, or what?
I think it was all of the above. Yeah, I think it's all of the above. You know, and I think that's. That's in entirely right to be thoughtful.
Mm.
This is, to me, this is all evidence that we're of progress, actually. You know, to me,
yeah.
You know, that we're thoughtful about these things. I think, but I what I recognise actually is that I do, like, I don't, and I mean, maybe this is kind of just a kind of. Because I'm in a privileged position because of the work that I've done over the last 20 or so years now. But I don't feel that I kind of need to ask permission to write something. You know, the only person I need to ask permission to write something is myself, you know. But I also think, Rebecca, that that's probably something I felt when I was 21, when I first started writing.
That you did need to ask permission.
No,
that
I didn't.
You didn't.
No,
right, okay.
That if I want to write something, then I should have a go at it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Now, along the way, I might discover that, one, this is not a good idea, or that because of various practical reasons, or that I can't do this, or that actually I'm not the right person, you know, there are all sorts of things I've tried to write over the years that have never seen the light of day,
yeah,
and that don't get further than five pages. But I've never had I've never thought, do I have permission to write this? And maybe that's a kind of a generational thing. It quite possibly is, you know. It's been, you know, I think with So Happy It Hurts, you know, and that novel, I just didn't think it was right for me to do it, you know, which is a slightly different thing, you know?
Yeah, you know,
I just didn't think it was right for me to do it. I thought, you know, I thought it should have been being written by a Millie, if I can put it in that way, you know. And I thought that... you know, for practical reasons as well, you know, like, it, you know, I was busy anyway. I think even if I hadn't been so busy, you know, I've always known that it's a bad idea to do things that are wrong for me to do, and also just like to earn money. And like, there've been, believe me, there've been periods when I've been really, really, really skinny. And I'm not very well off now either. You know, I'm a playwright. But you know,
yeah.
But I sort of have known, you know, that one, you know, if you kind of chase something just because someone else really wants you to do it, or because it's a money job, then I'm probably not going to do it kind of really, really well. And also, like, you always kind of, you end up earning the money from things that are really good pieces of writing, you know? So I've always known a thing that I need to try and keep my nerve as much as possible, you know, and that, like, can be a bit hairy. Yeah, of course it's hard. Yeah, of course it's hard. And, you know, people, you know, I'm sure people think, you know, when they read my tweets and all that, I think, you know, oh, he's probably made now, but I'm not.
Never are.
No.
I don't think, I mean, I'm sure there are some people that are, but you never are.
No, I always think I'm no more than a few months away from disaster at any given point.
Jesus, I'm not even a month.
Well, I mean, and I guess for me, you know, that feels like a real improvement on what it would have been 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Of course, for it to be, you know, maybe I'm kind of, you know, maybe it's more on the scheme of like 3 months or 6 months now, but, you know, but in terms of the writing, I come back to that, you know, thing, which is that I really have to try and do something that I feel is right to do.
Mm.
It's a kind of hard thing to explain that in some senses as well, because as I say, I've never been particularly a writer as well that kind of is like, it's got this kind of romantic passion for an idea that would be burning away. It's much more of a kind of a nagging thing. So there's more of a sense of me trying to listen to whether something's really nagging away at me or not, you know, and I, you know, and that's what I try to listen to, and then I'll get into it. There's a kind of sense of where, that's where that sense of whether something is right for me to do or not, I think, comes from, whether I should try and get into something or not. Does that make any sense, or sound bananas?
No, it totally does. Like, I really recognise that sense of, like, something that niggles at you.
Yeah.
Because in the work that I make that's kind of more contemporary performance style, that I mean, I could just say that I write it, but I feel like I don't want to claim that necessarily. It's always about this thing that's like, and ultimately what comes out is me trying to understand the irritation.
Yeah.
It's the pearl around the bit of grit, right? Yeah. Like, it's just trying to, like, neutralise it somehow. And sometimes if I haven't got enough complex thought around that, it just stays fucking irritating until I have the appropriate amount of thought.
Yeah.
Or not, or I have to give up.
Yeah, I recognise that. I mean, there's been a play, the next play that I want to write is an idea that I've had, you know, well, there are two actually, both ideas that I've had for quite some time that niggle away at me. And both things, one is a commission and one is not a commission. And in the last sort of 18 months, I've had a go on both of them and had full starts on both of them. And I sort of think it's my own version of what you describe in terms of your practice as enough complexity of thought around it. You know, that I think with both of them, somehow I was getting into writing out the kind of idea rather than it being really this kind of living thing.
Yeah.
And what is the real, I think somehow as well, it's like what is really sitting underneath this, you know? Mm. Which is not, is not the same as what Ted Hughes called his hidden most, which is the really, really deep reason that a writer might not even be aware of. So it's not quite that, but it's something that's maybe the kind of layer above that somehow. And in both of those plays, I haven't quite somehow got to that yet, you know, and I'm hoping that I will at some point, you know? Because I'd like to write those plays, but we'll see.
Because you'll have to give that commission fee back if you don't.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of mad, isn't it, all of that? It's sort of, you know, I've never sort of not delivered on a commission, but sometimes I have had commissions for years and years, you know?
Yeah.
And I think probably because the commission's for the Royal Court, and the Royal Court's not necessarily hard up for a few quid, it probably doesn't matter too much. I think though that when writers have sort of commissions from small companies, then you can't have that. You have to really write that. You have to really make the work.
Yeah, actually. And it's tough, isn't it? Because I really I'm a big fan of procrastination. I don't think you can make the thing until you're ready to make the thing. And I tell people all the time that if what you need to do to make the thing is eat ice cream and watch Friends for a day, that's probably what you should do.
Yeah, yeah.
Or something more erudite. And so I guess the Royal Court they've got the resources to allow that artistic freedom, allow things to come ready to prove, right? But if I couldn't, for my company, we couldn't do that.
Also as well, the court over commission, and obviously that's a separate argument, about, how much companies should commission or not. But I think, I think with the smaller companies, you really have to kind of honour that situation, as a writer. And I think also as well, I over the years have tried to be a big one on writers taking responsibility in various ways. And, I'm a member of the Writers Guild, and I am often at the end, in the old days, was at the end of a phone for people to ring me up about things, and now it's at the end of an email. And I'm always very sympathetic to other writers, but I also, often those conversations with writers about how they're being treated by management or whether they're unhappy or not. One of the things I always say is, well, they've broken the contract, but it sounds like you broke the contract first, because in your contract it will have said that you write the play within a year. That's generally what's within a writer's contract. And no one, probably except Mike Bartlett, maybe, writes a play within a year.
Yeah.
So writers are always the first people to break the contract. So we're never... Now, this isn't justifying a management treating a writer poorly in any way, but just remember that, because in this discussion, all we have is the contract, and actually, if you've taken 2.5 years to write a play that you were meant to write in a year, then what can you say when a theatre is meant to reply to you within however many weeks it says in a standard ITC contract, and, 5 months later, you haven't had a reply. You can't really say anything, you know? So, of course, you can say something, but do you know what I mean? So, it's very, it's very different. It's a very different thing, But, it's interesting in terms of my own, what I really don't like, though, is kind of writers just taking commissions for the sake of it, you know? It's that, I think, is a bit silly. I mean, that play for the court, it's to write something, a very specific thing, for Maxine Peake and Rory Kinnear to do together. And I just, my marriage broke up in the middle of it, and it sort of was a bit of a big thing that happened literally halfway through writing the play, and it's been really difficult to
go back to that place.
Because I felt like I was almost a completely different person within a year.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it slightly becomes a different issue, which is I still think it's a great idea. I'd still like to put those two people together in the theatre downstairs, and the story I've got, I think, is still a really good story to tell. But somehow, the whole reason for telling that story in 2019 as opposed to 2012-13, I haven't quite re-found why it is that I want to tell this particular story, you know. So I think kind of that's okay. And I think theatres understand that sometimes people are ill and sometimes they get divorced and sometimes they have babies and sometimes they have a terrible period of writer's block. I think managements know all this, but you know, that's much tougher on the small companies for sure.
I'm gonna resist my urge to get sidetracked. Coming back to something you said ages ago, which was about having benefited from the assisted places scheme.
Yes.
And finding that morally objectionable now.
Yeah.
And you're glad that that's been done away with, and sort of just thinking, because I'm just kind of thinking about your. Because you talked about politics and history as your, like, loves alongside the literature. What are you, like, do you think of what you're doing as a theatre, as a writer, as a playwright or screenwriter, do you think of that consciously in terms of it having an impact? Are you trying to change something, or is that incident, like, why are you doing this, is the simple question.
I think I am trying to change something, but I think what I'm trying to do is to change a person in some way,
right,
rather than necessarily to think that. I think there are very few works of art or dramas that have that kind of change society or politics, have a kind of immediate effect. There are some examples, like there was that French Algerian film, I think, is it Days of Glory? Brilliant war film about these soldiers from North Africa that served with the French army in the Second World War. And, you know, the way they were treated then was abysmally by the French government. I think President Mitterrand saw the film and it led to a change in the law.
Wow, that's
fantastic.
That's nice.
But I think that those examples are few and far between. So I prefer to operate on the level of trying to have an effect on an audience, and primarily on an emotional level, because I think that's how you affect people the most. If people
and that's
feel
how we
something,
actually make decisions, we just rationalise them after the fact.
I do like an audience to really, of course, engage with ideas. And when I go to the theatre, I like to engage with ideas. But primarily I'm trying to affect an audience emotionally, and that's what I'm trying to do. So I am trying to bring change in some small way. I think that the plays are political, but they're kind of not obviously political. You know, I try as I get older to be circumspect about what critics say about work, you know? But I've got to admit, I loved it when Susanna Clapp said in a review of In Basildon that she suddenly realised that she was watching a political play. Because I think that that's my intention a little bit. So I like to do a bit of the Trojan horse stuff. You know? And I'm really trying to do that in telly at the moment, the TV work I'm doing. Really, you know, using genre as a way of exploring things like England post-Brexit, the NHS, things like that, you know.
In a way that makes people, like, there's a show that I've been watching recently, and I can't remember who writes it, so I'm not going to name it.
That's okay.
But, yeah, it's so, like, it's so bleak that I've had to stop watching it. And I think if I could watch it to the end, it would probably be informative, and I might think differently.
Yeah.
But it's so bleak. I can't keep sitting with that as the possible future. You know.
Yeah. I mean, it's
so I like stealth meaningful.
Yeah. But also, these things come from our own experiences, and you know. So we sort of, right at the beginning of our chat, we're talking about the fact that how things changed for me as a sick former. You know. And one was doing the GCSE in drama, where we were improvising, and I'd never ever had any experience of it. It was a very sporty private school. And this woman, Ruth Barr, was brought in to kind of up the drama in the school, basically. And I couldn't believe it. We were kind of making stuff up on our feet, you know. And then the other thing was that I went to see my first proper play, age 17, which was King Lear.
Yeah.
And the emotional force of it. And I really believe that, like, one of the things that often drives artists is kind of being inspired by those things that first have that powerful effect on us. Now, for me, it's primarily as a playwright and a screenwriter. Mm. For someone else as a pianist, you know, it might be some concert they were first taken to or whatever. But, you know, the emotional force of John Wood's King Lear, and particularly the end, you know, and it's meant that I am drawn towards trying to make work that tries to have a powerful emotional effect on an audience. You know, I mean, as it happens, I quite like giving people a good time and making people laugh too along the way, because I think that's another way that we really connect with people. But probably the first thing is what John Osborne called giving audiences lessons in feeling. That's what he wanted to do. As a young playwright, he wanted to give an audience a lesson in feeling. And, you know, I that's what I like to do. And, you know, I don't, you know, like to see people upset by my work, but I like people to cry.
Yeah, maybe the right amount of upset.
You know, there have been, so, for example, you know, like I never... So I don't... It's not the... So I'm not so interested in shock and awe. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
A kind of shock and awe type work where you terrify or you really shock or you really upset an audience. And I've had two plays where sometimes there have been audience members, I think, that have genuinely been triggered and upset by the plays. And that's something I've not liked at all. But, of course, when you see an audience member who's really engaged in something and they wipe away some tears or they laugh at a joke or they're really sitting forward and you know they're really engaged with the story, then that's what I feel we're trying to do, right? So that's brilliant, yeah. But that all comes, you have to kind of engage with people, I think, you know, and I think that's how you persuade people, you know, to think about the world in a different way and how you get people to empathise and try and stand in someone else's shoes at least for a couple of hours, you know?
Yeah, totally.
You know, and I know from my own theatre going, you know, that when you... I just love it when you come out of a theatre and have a sense somehow that the world is slightly different because of the play.
I mean, that's what you want, right? Like, you want to leave and the trees are filled with angels or whatever, or like it's different, you leave into a different reality to the one you entered from.
Yeah, well, I the one that's coming to mind for me is Leo Butler's play about that young kid that was on at the Almeida.
Isn't it called Boy?
Boy, that's it.
Yeah.
Boy,
yeah.
That's exactly right. It was escaping me for a minute. And I remember sort of walking from the Almeida up to Highbury and Islington to get on the tube. And I somehow was looking at Upper Street in a different way.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, probably, you know, probably kind of by the time I was having a coffee the following morning... maybe, you know, the world kind
the habit
of
had returned.
Yeah, had reassembled into kind of my sort of, you know, standard perspective of it. But it left its trace for sure, because I'm still talking about it, what, 3 or 4 years later. That's a real memory of kind of looking, you know. I remember particularly noticing the homeless people actually on Upper Street, and maybe I wouldn't have quite the same way. You know,
I think my equivalent of that, because I've had some of those in different ways. I think my equivalent is, do you remember Wallace Shawn did The Fever at the
Court?
That, and I sort of left. I left transformed and I left thinking and feeling differently about the world.
Yeah.
And I remember being like, fuck, I want to do that to people. And then talking to someone about it. In a job, an interview for one of those directors' awards or whatever, and then being like, oh, well, it's not really a play, is it? And I'm like, fuck off! Like, it meant some, you know, I remember being so hurt by how dismissive that particular person was of it. And it was really, like, I treasured it in a way that I think it's really rare to treasure.
Yeah.
An experience.
What was it you were interested in to do with the assisted places scheme and all of that?
It was just because I was just kind of conscious of you.
Oh, it's to do with the politics.
Of the politics and just being aware that you're like, I benefited from that, but I also. You said something like, I benefited from that, but I object to its existence, or something, you know.
Oh, well, I just think that private schools should, if they should have many more scholarships and bursaries that they fund themselves, or they should have the charitable status taken away. You know, I think it's quite simple, really. And I think the idea that local, you know, I think it's with a noble, sort of noble intent that local authorities could send working class kids to get a private school education, you know, is a noble objective. But when you think about it, you know, I think
it would be much more noble to just fix the state fucking
well,
education.
Well, exactly. You sort of take the words out of my mouth. Yeah. And for independent schools to do the right thing, you know. So that's why I sort of thought that the Blair government were right to get rid of that, you know. And I do, you know, I mean, I think there's what you do in the kind of act of writing itself. But, you know, I mean, theatre is in, you know, it's funny to me that all these years later we still have to remake these arguments, but it's important that we do. But that theatre is an inherently political act. And there are times in history, and there are certainly other cultures in the world, where the very act of making theatre is something that is at odds with the agenda of the state is dangerous. And it's because, you know, the very act of gathering people together in a public space, you know, to be part of a story that's hopefully going to encourage them to think about the world in a different way is also an inherently political act. You know, and I think that we particularly, you know, in this world of kind of increasingly of authoritarian and populist politicians having the appeal that they do, these are things that we cannot be too complacent about, you know? I would sort of say, you know, one of the things that sort of affected me most over the years was it was in 2001, I was part of a group from the National Theatre that went to South Africa as part of a kind of cultural exchange, you know, us pitching up, doing workshops, talks, you know, the kind of British Council sponsored shebang. And, you know, essentially playwriting post-apartheid lost its way a bit in South Africa.
Let us, your former colonisers, fix that for you.
Sort that all out. you know, my anecdote is absolutely apropos of that.
Yeah.
It's a brilliant and sobering moment, which was that, you know, in the first week was in Cape Town, the second week in Johannesburg, and so we were coming along and the workshops and discussions and everything, sort of all of them seemed to go quite well, you know, and people who came enjoyed them. Until the morning that was on subtext, basically. And so there was me and the director Mick Gordon, and there might have been Tanika Gupta might have been there. She was the other playwright who was on the trip, and Mick had done some lovely work with them from Uncle Vanya, you know, the famous kind of map reading scene with Astroth and Yelena. You know, he'd done some lovely work with them and that. Tanika and I were did some playwriting type stuff on subtext, and we became aware that the group became more and more stony-faced and cold and irritated and one or two burgeoning towards anger. And we were like, I had no fucking clue, you know what I mean? Like going, what's going on? What have we done?
Yeah.
You know, and then, like, basically, finally, it might have been Mick, as the director in the room, who asked them what was wrong. And basically, one of the guys just said, we've spent our whole lives being told that we cannot say what we want to say, and we are not going to do that anymore. You're coming here telling us that we have to hide what we want to say.
Ah.
So this is why we're really, really angry about this
subtext.
Idea. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was a good fucking lesson. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It was a lesson in all sorts of things. It's maybe a lesson in a kind of arrogance that you joked about, a post-colonial arrogance that you joked about. It's also an idea, maybe about a Western idea about playwriting, that while, you know, it might be quite good within the context of this hallowed institution here as part of the University of London to be talking about five-act structures and subtext and arcs and tone points. Well, within a different culture, actually, these ideas might not be so valuable, and there might be other storytelling ideas that are valuable.
Yeah, and also, like, the right to half say something comes from a position of incredible privilege where you have as many words as you need.
That's right, that's exactly right. And you've certainly got no one necessarily telling you that you...
Yeah, can't say it.
Can't say it, you know, in the way that they were experienced to. So you know, it's a kind of, you know, it's almost kind of acts as a kind of a memento mori for me, that, you know, that memory, you know, to remember, you know, that we are in a relatively kind of privileged position, and, you know, to put on, you know, it would be a dangerous thing to put on an Alan Ayckbourn comedy within some theatre cultures, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, not to be complacent about any of that, and not to eschew that label either, do you know what I mean, when it comes your way occasionally. Of course, I'm not a playwright of, you know, like Howard Brenton, you know, or David Edgar, you know, both brilliant playwrights of a different generation, and old friends, you know, but they're, you know, they make different work to me, you know, they're maybe more kind of direct, maybe in terms of how they are, the way that they engage with politics than I. But I'm, you know, I feel quite proud of a kind of seam in my work that, you know, that is interested in the world that we live in, and why it's the way that it is, and what are the power structures that mean it's that way, and how do we interact with that, albeit on a kind of a level that's kind of where it's in the kind of bones of it all, rather than being on the top line, you know, because that's me, you know. I haven't been able to write for 4 days because of the shenanigans in Westminster.
Yeah, I think there's a thing. So a thing that the listening audience won't know is that I just did a small gesture that implied I wanted to kill myself when David mentioned Howard Brenton. Howard, if you're listening, I'm sorry. I don't mean to be rude. I don't know you at all. But I'm, because I think there's a cost, isn't there, in being, in like, the more politically engaged you are, the bigger the risk that history will not look on you kindly.
What do you mean? What do you mean by that?
Do you know what? Like, I just—it's because I just directed, as a favour for a friend, I directed a Howard's. I directed Epsom Downs.
Oh yeah, I was in that play at university. Yeah, right, well, okay. I was a stage manager in that play. We did it at uni.
And it's. Oh my God.
What do you mean that the plays are dated?
Well, I think, I mean, obviously it's so specific, right? There's such a specific time and place.
Yeah.
Of course it is dated. But there's also a thing where, like, if you read that as a woman who exists now in this world, and you look at the treatment of the female characters, not just by the male characters, but by the writer and, to an extent, the director in the creation of that piece, you're like, you fucking misogynist assholes. I shun your work, right? Which probably isn't fair, but also it feels fair. you know, and so having just spent quite a lot of time essentially justifying to having to be in the position of justifying to, like, a 20-something-year-old actress why this character, why it's okay that this 15-year-old traveller girl is overtly sexualized and never has a space to speak against that, or it just made me really angry, and it just made me think that anger at the politics that it espoused unknowingly, whereas it's, you know, it's as a play, you know, as a play about kind of a snapshot of class and privilege, there's all sorts of really right on smart Marxist stuff in there, while completely neglecting some other stuff that I really care about. So it just made me realise that, as someone who kind of thinks about the work I make as quite consciously politically engaged.
Yeah.
It's just made me realise that probably the price that I pay for that, should there be playtext of it one day,
yeah,
is that people will think I'm a cunt in some way or other. Because that's how it goes. That's progress.
Yeah, maybe they will and maybe they won't. But I agree. I mean, that kind of is progress. And it's also actually to do with taste as well. I think people sort of... You know, I mean, it just is to do with taste, you know, as well. And it's to do with
Hang on. But also, like, fully rounded human. Like, for example, that particular character, because you know the play, right?
Yeah.
So that particular character, like, it isn't a taste thing that she doesn't ever get to go, you pervert, right?
Yeah, no, but
That's an oversight.
But of course it's an oversight, and I'm not arguing against that. I think it was a play that's written at its time.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
that's
I think that because...
You have to forgive it, because it is of its time.
Well, it just, whether you forgive it or not, it just is of its time, and it doesn't do things that ordinarily a play might do now with regards to the way that particular character is drawn.
And becomes human.
And has a voice in the story, and has and all of that, but I think that I don't know, it's just because, you know, so how long is it now? So it's 24 years now, and just in those 24 years of working in the theatre, you know, I've seen different things that have managements and audiences and cultures have interests in different areas, and also different things being fashionable. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And I, it may be that within another 40 years that no bugger has any interest in Howard's play at all.
Yeah.
But it may be that at that time that, you know, it becomes fashionable to look at these plays that were written in the 1970s.
Yeah.
And that actually the way into it is because they're kind of interested in that particular seam of playwriting, as bananas as that might seem to us now. Do you know what I mean?
But absolutely, as a seam within the soil of metaphors
run out. No. I think that one can't just say it's to do with that. But I essentially agree with the idea that it's just to do with progress. You know,
I also think people will see, like, the Me Too or whatever plays of today that I find incredibly didactic and heavy-handed, some of them, and very, very orthodox and authoritarian, which I have a huge problem with. Like, I think people will also look at those and be like, well, that's nonsense. What? How do we all exist in this together if you're just going to turn everyone into flesh cars?
But I mean, that's just to do with, isn't it? That's to do with when the thesis of a play becomes what's really of overriding importance, you know?
Yeah.
And again, I would argue that there have been many periods in theatre history when that's been the case, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you know, the kind of ebb and flow of that, you know, is something that happens. I would just say, though, as a theatre goer, that, you know, you get the kind of shifting fashions and tastes and interests of writers and theatre makers. Generally, as a theatre goer, as much as a theatre maker, I mean, I just have always enjoyed having a fairly diverse meal. Do you know what I mean? And I think that what happens is just actually, you know, if I feel that I've had, you know, two or three plays that... you know, that are kind of quite thesis heavy or are quite handy and didactic in their relationship with their audience, then I might give work like that a miss for a while, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And go and see a musical in the West End, you know?
Yes.
And I think, you know, no one is kind of compelled to go and see all these plays.
Except for me, because it's actually my job. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, so, you know, I think any more than anyone is compelled to write these plays, actually, you know. I don't know, you know.
Yeah, I think I was probably just unfair to Epsom Downs because it was so self-consciously political and a bit kind of preachy.
I sort of remember
on the
my
one hand.
Yeah, but it's funny you talk about it because you say, well, I know. I mean, I just remember my friends in it more than I remember the play, actually, in the drama department at Exeter. And the two of the guys who were playing the horses.
Yes.
Being very vain before they went on. And one of them used to sort of stick a hairdryer on his prick. and the other one used to try and dip his prick in a pint of warm water.
To make him swell up. Amazing.
Or at least that they're not too small.
Amazing.
So, you know, poor Howard.
Well, I mean, they're playing racehorses. They're just going in as a character, right? Yeah. They're going to be well endowed. God, yeah. Anyway, right. I feel like I've been talking to you for much longer than I'm supposed to already. Last question is, when you'll have heard me ask this to other people, you can interpret it as you wish. When you go from this place,
yeah.
By which I don't want you to think this office, but like this astral plane or this place in your career or theatre. What do you want to leave behind?
With regards to my work,
I mean, you can choose. I usually say, what do you want people to say about you?
Well, I think, given that we're doing this in the context of our work in the theatre, I want to sort of think of something in terms of my work in the theatre rather than on any kind of general kind of.
But
personal
you're also
level.
Allowed because it's you're also allowed to say if that's what's important. Like Dominic Cook was like, I just want people to like think I was a nice guy.
Yeah.
And like so if that's what's important to you, that's okay. It's important that people know that what's important
well,
to us is actually.
There's
kids.
Probably a couple of things that I'd like to say. Is that all right?
Yeah.
If I can say there's probably a couple of things like that to say. So, you know, if I was ever invited on Desert Island Discs,
right.
I would find it impossible to choose the one. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That was the one, you know.
Yeah.
So it's true to me to say a couple of things. I think that the nicest thing anyone has ever said about me was about 10 years ago, and I won't say who it was that someone said that I always tried to do the right thing by everyone.
Mm.
And I thought that was a really nice thing, and I felt very choked.
Yeah.
And I thought if anyone more than that person that said it thought that about me after I was gone, then I think that would be great to be remembered in that way. In terms of my work as a playwright and within the theatre, if anyone remembered me because they'd seen a play of mine and thought that had a really great night, then I'd be really happy with that.
Okay. Nice. That's nice.
That's it.
Yeah. That's fair. Is there anything you feel like you haven't said or you want to say or you should correct? This is your moment.
No, not at all. I've really enjoyed talking to you. It's been really, really interesting to talk about the stuff to do with school and class and how that relates to the writing in terms of permission and also and perspective. Because I think often when people do talk to me about it, if you get a journalist that is interested in it, or I talked to Simon Stevens a bit about it last year. On the Court podcast, I think we often talk about it in terms of the subject matter, like in a kind of way, like because you went to a posh school and then you went to university and then you've kind of worked within the theatre where there are loads of middle class people, you can kind of write the knot of the heart, and also because you come from where you come, you can write in Basildon. So there's kind of quite a literal way of talking about it to do with subject matter, but actually in many ways I've really enjoyed the thornier and knottier area that you've been talking about, that clearly you've experienced somewhat yourself, which is to do with kind of permission and perspective, actually, somehow, you know? So I hope that people that are listening to the podcast, you know, I hope that's something that maybe they'd reflect upon, because it is a truly complicated thing, because it's bound up with your identity as a person.
Yeah. Yeah,
actually.
It's so exposing even give space to the thought, I think it's a tricky thing.
And massive if you're someone like me who was terrified when they went to private school because they didn't know what cutlery to use. And that never ever, when we got the parents of kids who gave us an odd lift home to Romford, my brother and I didn't let them drop them outside our house because we didn't want them to see what our house looked like. So those things were fucking massive.
Yeah.
And to make a journey from that kind of feeling to having to trying to find a voice and sometimes having a very clear voice within the theatre is it's a real journey, that, you know. People think I'm a very different person now to the person they knew at 17 that was very shy and taciturn.
Because you keep changing, right?
I think there is
a thing about the permission that feels really important to me. Like one of my sisters is a brilliant drawer and painter.
Draftswoman,
that'll do, that's a word. And she and at school, she didn't go to the school I did. At school she excelled at that, and excelled at art. And at parents' evening of her A-level year, the teacher took my parents aside, her form teacher, was like, well, look, this is the only thing she's any good at, and she's never going to make a career of that.
Awful.
And she's actually a landscape architect now, and a successful, you know, a relatively successful one. But no one ever said that to me, and so weirdly, I was a scholarship kid, but it would have been worth paying for no one to ever say that to me. If we, you know, actually, what it would be worth is paying for no one to ever say that to anyone in
all
of that.
Yes, of course.
So yeah. Anyway, thank you so much.
No, thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of The Legacy Tapes. This is just a quick correction. The sharp-eared amongst you might have heard me refer to Mike Bartlett as the artistic director of The Bush early on in the podcast. Obviously, I meant Mike Bradwell and was having a stupid 5 minutes. So, sorry to all of the Mikes. Do forgive me. Also, while I'm here and I'm talking to you, if you would like to make a donation to help support the work of the podcast and maybe make sure that I do my research a little bit better and don't make so many mistakes, you can now do so at patreon.com/thelegacytapes. Thanks for listening.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.